Hi, this is Corey Olson, the Tolkien Professor, and welcome to another episode of the Silmarillion Seminar.
Hi, welcome to episode 13 of the Silmarillion Seminar. My name is Chris Stevens for the Tolkien Professor and my fellow Silmarillionaires. Tonight's episode is chapter 12 of the Silmarillion entitled Of Men. One title that's been suggested for this episode is Of Men, the Nightfearers, and Other Elvish Hang-Ups. Without further delay, let's join the seminar.
Okay, good evening, everybody. We can start here. I think, Mike, you had a question about the name. Morgoth is here called in one place Morgoth Bauglir, B-A-U-G-L-I-R. That means the constrainer, like the one who constrains, which I think sort of essentially seems to be referring to, you know, like him as the keeper of prisoners and the keeper of slaves. But yeah, that's the literal translation of Bauglir, the one who constrains, which is a little bit odd. It's not exactly the most, vile insult I can imagine throwing at Morgoth. But that is sort of the nickname that he is given, or rather the additional name. And you can see that I mentioned insult because in times when it is used, it tends to be used as if insultingly. That is, when someone is speaking very scathingly, of Morgoth, they will often call him Morgoth Bauglir. Which sounds really good. I mean, it sounds really insulting. But we don't actually, its meaning is sort of not quite as obviously insulting as perhaps we could wish. But anyway, okay, let's see. The, second question that you guys had was, Chris. The bodies of the elves being more like those of men in the old days. You want to go ahead and start that one?
I really just thought about that on the spur of the moment, so I may not have a coherent question, but I was thinking of Glorfindel in the time of the Lord of the Rings versus the elves in the Elder Days. I always pictured him being just as strong or as powerful. You know, I don't envision him having been consumed from within and being less than either the men or the elves of the elder days, and I just want to get anybody else's thoughts on that and what's going on, or what maybe not enough time has passed as far as the theoretical writer of this is saying. Let me find it here.
Yeah,
in those
that
days
passed.
They were
yeah.
more
go ahead,
of
go ahead.
Men, and maybe it's almost like they're sounding like they're talking in the theoretical present day about the elves back in the First Age.
Right. Right. Yeah, yeah. We might as well read that bit a bit. Immortal were the elves, and their wisdom waxed from age to age, and no sickness nor pestilence brought death to them. Their bodies indeed were of the stuff of earth, and could be destroyed, and in those days they were more like to the bodies of men, since they had not so long been inhabited by the fire of their spirit, which consumes them from within in the courses of time. That's definitely the sort of the passage in question here. A couple of you had some thoughts on that. Laura, what were you thinking?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I thought the same thing that that Chris did when I read that. It's almost as if the author was in the present day, which I thought was really interesting for this book, supposedly written at about the time of the Lord of the Rings. Why would they be talking about elves sort of being shadows, or because in the Lord of the Rings, they're definitely not shadows.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is a really good point. It isn't, there's no question that here, and there are not that many points like this. That is, the narrative of the Silmarillion tends to stay reasonably close. I mean, we know that we're hearing these things told, you know, and written down long, long after the fact, of course. There's not like an illusion that we're getting a contemporary account exactly. But you're right, this is one which sort of brings in explicitly a later and presumably a Third Age perspective on this, but only really by implication. In those days, they were more like to the bodies of men, with the implication they're not so much anymore. And I think here we can see, well, Tolkien's ideas on this sort of changed over time. Way back at the very beginning, I made a big deal of this in my Tolkien course that I taught at the college last year, which is the way that the idea of fairies and elves came over time post-Renaissance to be, you know, sort of increasingly the tiny little diminutive creatures. And I talked a lot about Tolkien's objection to this concept of fairies in On Fairy Stories when he was complaining about the whole, you know, the little Victorian fairies which, you know, disappear into cowslips and stuff like that. And how much he objected to that and, you know, how one of the things that he does that Tolkien does with his elves, you know, in The Lord of the Rings is basically to kind of re-ennoble, the idea of elves and fairies, though he ended up sort of ditching the use of the word fairies. When he first wrote these stories, he didn't use the word elf almost at all. He used the word fairy most of the time, but he clearly, he knew that if he did that, he would be fighting against these associations all the time, so he used the word elf instead. But anyway, I'm getting distracted now. Okay, so he objected to this whole, like, small, tiny little fairy thing, and was moving against that. But in his original conceptions, way back, you know, when Tolkien was in his teens and twenties, he had not yet really distanced himself in that way. This conviction of his, this sort of irritation of his with this tradition of tiny little winged fairies is a later, like, it grows on him over his life. Towards the beginning of his life, many of his early poems, for instance, contain references to fairies which are clearly tiny little cowslip fairies. So he himself wrote in that mode, and he actually conceived in the Lost Tales, he makes reference to the fact that, that the elves, the fairies, are over time eventually going to become the tiny little fairies, of the Victorian world, you know, of really of the post-Renaissance world. And, go ahead. Sorry.
That's kind of what struck me about the tone of it, as Laura also spoke about, is that it doesn't sound like a third age perspective in this tone. It sounds again more like a contemporary or a modern looking back. Someone who knows of the elves now being little tiny fairy creatures, maybe, and is making a comparison in that way rather than from third age to first age elves.
Yeah, and I'm tempted to call this, in a sense, I was going to say a Christopher Tolkienism, but that sounds unfair. What I mean is, I suspect that this passage is one of those which is really a big editorial challenge for Christopher Tolkien, because this is a relic of one of those old passages where he was thinking explicitly in those ways, because of course, you know, as we know and have talked about before, you know, Middle-earth and Beleriand were supposed to have been, in his initial conception, were to have been our world and England and Europe of long ago, and so therefore, he was explicitly connecting it not just to the Third Age, which he had not really worked out very well. The Third Age didn't exactly exist yet when he was first writing these stories, but rather to that bridge to the modern age. And so when he originally said in the Book of Lost Tales that they used to be of human stature, what he meant was not tiny, but, you know, full size. They were, you know, between 5 and 7 feet tall, not like 3 inches tall, and that they have dwindled over time until they have become only inches tall. Now, Christopher Tolkien is clearly using here, obviously the Silmarillion is being written, is being put together in the post Lord of the Rings, you know, phase of Tolkien's life. So this is reflecting many of his later thoughts, though not all of his last thoughts. So when Christopher Tolkien is putting together the Silmarillion to publish it after Tolkien's death, he's bringing together stuff, texts from all over the place. Some passages which were relics of earlier times, some passages which he had changed, some which didn't really all fit together. I mean, Tolkien hadn't cleaned all this stuff up. Now, I think that this passage, this is not an argument to say that this passage is simply a contradiction, that it doesn't fit at all. It does fit. And if you think about the way especially people like Galadriel talk about fading and all of that, fading is happening to the elves in the Third Age. They are diminishing. Not necessarily getting shorter, but they're diminishing. They will become a woodland folk. They will become, you know, smaller and lesser creatures. Not necessarily, you know, they're not necessarily going to turn into Puck from Midsummer Night's Dream, which they were going to originally, but they are going to fade now. That's sort of his new sense of, you know, the new way that he talks about what's going to happen to them over time. So.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And of course, we've talked about this before, the difficulty of comparing segments of the Silmarillion to the later works. And I would never criticize Christopher Tolkien for anything that he did in the original publication, just because he didn't have the benefit of all the material we have available to us today to put something maybe a little bit more coherent together.
But, yeah, well, it's hard. Anyway. I mean, this is the stuff that he's been developing over time too. I mean, you can see throughout the History of Middle-earth series, as he goes through and puts all the papers in order and develops all of the commentaries on the entire evolution of the story, there are times in the History of Middle-earth series where he explicitly says, okay, if I were doing the Silmarillion all over again, I'd do this bit differently. You know, or I regret having changed this, or I regret there are some moments, not a whole lot, but there are a few times where you can see him doing that. So it certainly is likely that if things were different and Christopher were now putting together the Silmarillion, it probably wouldn't look exactly the way that it does here. But again, nevertheless, I do think that it still works. And an interesting thing also to be taken from this passage is not only the fading business, that is that in those days their bodies were more like to the bodies of men, but the business about since they had not so long been inhabited by the fire of their spirit, which consumes them from within the courses of time. And here I come back to that Galadriel point, Glorfindel, rather, observation. Glorfindel's spirit, when Frodo sees Glorfindel's spirit on the banks of the River Bruinen, and his spirit is, you know, this radiant white shining like a flame, we can see his spirit like a flame. And we're told, Gandalf, that is, explains to Frodo when he wakes up that it looks like that. Glorfindel's spirit looks like that because he's Caliquendi. And, you know, he has a different relationship with, like, his body and spirit have a kind of a different relationship than the one that even other elves, the Moriquendi, have. Yeah. Because Glorfindel is an Noldor. He comes from Valinor. So,
well, one last point I wanted to say, the whole idea of the fire of their spirit consuming them from within, to me that idea kind of blends well with the idea of fading.
Yeah.
Their bodies kind of just burn away or fade away over time. I'm stretching the metaphor a little bit, but the at least for me that the image that creates kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah, and I mean that idea of them being consumed as if the spirits and the bodies of elves don't really fit very well together. You know, I mean, it's almost as if it opens up the possibility of imagining a kind of innate conflict between the body and spirit of the elves. If their body can't really hold their spirits, which I think is a really interesting, it's a really interesting concept. And I'm not sure that I fully understand it or that it's really fully developed here, but it's really intriguing, I think.
It's kind of odd, since the elves have to stay in Ea, that their bodies would be subject to falling apart, if you will. Whereas men, they're not, their bodies are supposed to fall apart because their spirits are supposed to go away. So
right.
It is kind of odd in that context. And I'll shut up for a while.
That's okay. No, that's good. Joe, you wanted to make a point, I think, a second ago?
No, yeah, I was just going to ask, what do you think was the purpose of their spirits being able to consume their bodies, like, not necessarily quickly, but over time. I mean, especially if they weren't going to die. I mean, I just didn't know what the connection would have been, why everyone might have done that. Like, what was the thinking behind that? Maybe even though their bodies wouldn't be there, their spirits would still be there for the final, like, battle in the end, the music, or I wasn't sure.
Well, they can get new bodies. Glorfindel being the primary example of this, since we're already talking about him. I mean, we will meet Glorfindel later on, and he will die. I mean, he will die in the narrative later on, several chapters from now. And he is the same Glorfindel that we meet in the Fellowship of the Ring. So he is sort of the primary example. Elves' spirits over time can, they can, when their bodies die and their spirits go to the halls of Mandos, they can be permitted to get a new body again. So, that is possible. This, you know, we're told that does and can happen. This came up, remember, briefly when we were talking about the awkwardness of Finwë's second marriage in this regard. So in that way, that, you know, the bodies and spirits are not sort of attuned together. But I think, remember this passage about the fire of their spirits consuming the bodies from within, when we get to the death of Fëanor, which will happen pretty soon. And we shouldn't talk about that in too much detail now because we haven't gotten there yet. But I just want to kind of note that because, we will definitely want to come back to that. Any other, Mike, I think you had wanted to say something before about this passage?
The relationship between the fire of their spirits and fading. I put in my margin the final paragraph that mentioned the elves fading, waning, retreating to the woods and the caves and becoming as shadows. I put in the margin there. That reminded me of the elven king in The Hobbit. I don't know if that's on point or not.
Explain that a little bit more. How did it remind you of the elven king?
Well, just the paragraph that describes how in the later times the elves began to retreat. They took to the moonlight, to the woods, to the caves, becoming as shadows and memories. And so the way that the elves and the elven king are depicted in the Hobbit seemed quite a lot like that, as opposed to maybe how they existed in earlier periods.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that certainly is fair in a sense, you could say. That in with the elves of Mirkwood, we get a kind of transitional state that is, you know, of the elves. They are definitely a couple pegs down from the Noldor. Obviously, they are the closest parallel, of course, between the elven with the elven king is Thingol, of course. I mean, you know, the elven king and the elves of Mirkwood are a lot like Thingol and the elves of Doriath. In fact, the halls of the elven king are almost exactly like Menegroth. It's like, you know, little sort of the junior Menegroth over there in Mirkwood. And there's no Melian, though. Absolutely no Melian figure. That's the chief difference. I should mention, John Ratliff in The History of the Hobbit has, he expands for quite a while on his theory that basically the Elven King of Mirkwood originally was Thingol. There's some evidence in the early drafts that basically the world that he was considering, in The Hobbit, since he was already working on the Silmarillion stuff, and he was sort of assuming that the Silmarillion stuff was never going to get published, that when he was writing The Hobbit, he, was basically setting The Hobbit, in the Silmarillion world, though he wasn't explaining all this, and he wasn't giving all the Silmarillion backstory, because again, he assumed that was going to be irrelevant and nobody would ever care. But, he incorporates this stuff, and he doesn't give them names, the implications are, at least possible that he was certainly associating him with Thingol, whether or not he actually envisioned him as Thingol himself initially. He certainly doesn't do that later on when he'll go on to give him a different name in history. The passage that I'm thinking of in connection with your observation there, Mike, in The Hobbit. I'm trying to find the passage in The Hobbit, whenever I'm trying to find something very quickly. I'm rarely able to. But anyway, the passage being when in The Hobbit, when he says that, you know, that basically these elves, you know, if they had a fault, it was distrust of strangers, but elves they were and remain, that is, good people. That is, we can see they're still noble, they're still great, but they're clearly lower than the elves of old. And the elven king in The Hobbit is a little bit self-conscious that he doesn't have quite so great a hoard of treasure as the legendary elven kings of old. And so that's one of the reasons he wants to get more. So anyway, I do think that there is sort of an interesting connection there. And of course, in that light also, we get the Avari returning in this chapter, which we haven't seen or thought about in a long time. And that was interesting to see that they are still there. And also that they, although, you know, they are called, you know, although they are dark elves and they are the unwilling and they are the wild elves and everything, one might be tempted to sort of think of them not being good people, you know, that they have become savage in the wilderness and everything. But they seem to be they certainly, compared to the first humans, are very wise and benevolent and teachers and seem kind and everything. So, you know, the Avari actually still seem to be good people, which I think is actually kind of interesting and easy to forget about. So anyway, so that's I think definitely pretty cool. Okay. Let's see. Jason, you had a question about the Valar and their relationship with men.
Yes, I thought it was interesting that the Valar do very little to try to communicate with the men. It says that they try to send the messages through the water and the men can't understand it. And so it's like the Valar just give up almost. And of course, when the elves awoke, there was a lot of advances. You know, Orome goes and meets them and they have all kinds of communication and they invite them to Valinor, and it just seems as though the Valar, either they're not as interested in the men, or they've got a once-bitten-twice-shy attitude after what happened with the elves, or I'm interested in your thoughts or anybody's thoughts on why there seems to be that distance between the Valar and the men.
I think that's a great question. What do people think? Does anybody have any thought about that? Anyone want to pitch in? Yeah, Jack, go ahead.
I'll jump in.
Oh, Dave, sure, go ahead.
So we've touched on the fact before, a long time ago, we speculated that there seemed to be, the elves seemed to have a closer relationship with Valar. Men seem to have seem to have sort of a direct connection to Iluvatar, that they sort of, you know, later on in Numenor, they build temples to him and they speak about him a lot, whereas the elves seem, their relationship with him, the Valinor seem to intercede in it. I'm wondering if maybe that, I mean, was that sort of Iluvatar's intention? Like, was that by design? I don't know if it seems to be sort of a chicken and an egg problem, because there's lots of language in this chapter and later ones about how maybe men's destinies aren't in the hands of Valar, the men are at variance with the Valar, they don't know much about them, they feared them rather than loved them, and I don't know if that's sort of, I mean, is that all caused by the Valar's sort of distance and the fact that they don't, you know, intervene directly with the men, or is that sort of by design? Iluvatar intends for the men to not have much of a relationship with them.
Yeah, I mean, no, that's I agree with the chicken and egg thing. I mean, certainly on the one hand, it's easy enough to see, given the different natures of elves and men, that the elves are kind of more naturally in more of something like a partnership relationship with the Valar. I mean, of course, they're not operating on the same level, but both of them are bound to Arda. You know, the elves live as long as the world goes on. You know, and they're bound to the world, and the Valar are bound to the world by their love for it. And we're told at the beginning when they descend into Ea, they become bound to it. So both of them are there. They're like, you know, they're the team. They're going to be seeing this whole world thing through to the end. The elves not from the beginning, but they will be lasting until the end. Whereas, of course, the humans are coming and going. It's not like they're going to be operating together. Not that the elves and Valar are operating on the same level by any stretch, but I think that we can see that. So in that sense, certainly. A bunch of people want to jump in. Jack, why don't you go first?
A bit simpler. I think maybe the Valar just burnt out on the elves, and maybe they didn't want to go through the same thing again with men, or perhaps they realized their mistake with the elves. They interfered too much and are just taking a completely different approach. Hands off.
Yeah, I mean, given the things that we've been seeing and talking about with the ways in which the invitation of the elves to Valinor sort of backfires, and I don't just mean by like the whole Noldor thing, like, well, clearly, you know, that didn't pan out, but not just that. They were the ways in which it seems that the invitation was not necessarily a good idea in the first place, and that the rebellion of the Noldor is only just kind of a confirmation that, you know, that a problem had been created by the Valar in the first place. I think that's certainly one way to look at it. Not that the Valar's, I almost said failure to reach out to the men, which suggests that it's a bad idea. But they're not reaching out to the men. They're being hands off is like an act of neglect. You know, they don't care about the men. I don't think that, at least I don't think we need think that. I think that we can see it as, you know, like a plan, on purpose. And that frankly, it might be a better plan. Laura, go ahead.
Yeah, a couple things about that. It does seem like by the time the men come around, the Valar have decided that hands off is the better way to go. But also, I think there's just something different about men. The Valar seem to be pretty hands off with them throughout, almost as if they don't even try to connect with the men at all or even talk to them the way they do with the elves. Even in The Lord of the Rings, by the time we get to that, the only people that are mentioning any of the Valar, the elves, and the men, the most we ever see them do is maybe bow to the west, but that's about it. So it's almost like the Valar want to treat men a different way, maybe because the gift of Iluvatar, and the Valar aren't sure what happens to them afterwards, and they just seem generally almost, they just want to leave them alone and sort of see what happens instead of being more hands-on like they are with the elves.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think it's a really good way to be thinking about it. Elizabeth, go ahead.
Yeah, this could be coming from way out in left field, but I was just thinking that way back when we were talking about the Cimmerils, we were discussing how no mortal flesh could touch them, and that could have been because of the original sin of men, and I was wondering if maybe that whole issue of original sin has to do with why the Valar were so hands-off with men.
Well, and that is a good point, and it's not really developed here, of course, in this passage, but there are other places where we get this sense. Tolkien never talks about it in detail, even in the debate between Finrod and Andreth that I've mentioned before, that story that is printed in Morgoth's Ring, which Tolkien wrote after The Lord of the Rings. Even there, which discusses this kind of thing much more explicitly than Tolkien does anywhere else. Even there, he doesn't talk about original sin very clearly. But there is this sense, and we will get a couple references later on, to this shadow that lies in the heart of men, which is kind of like the doom of the Noldor. So there is this sense of that's existence, but I don't think that what we're seeing is like a rejection of them by the Valar. One could see a kind of parallel, I think, between that the Valar are hands off with the Noldor and the way that they're hands off with men. But I'm not even sure that that's quite fair in the end, because with the Noldor, the lack of intervention by the Valar on the part of the Noldor, as we will see, you know, the Noldor, like, things are gonna kind of go from bad to worse to worse to worse with the Noldor in Beleriand, over the next many centuries, and the Valar are not going to do anything to step in and save them from the suffering that they're going to be undergoing. There, you see, that makes a good deal more sense, because they're the Noldor are kind of reaping what they sowed. That policy is merely an extension of what Manwë said before, which was, hey, you know, if you guys want to go, you can go. But if you go, if you want to separate yourself from us, we'll let you separate yourself from us. But guess what? Then you're going to be separate from us. And that's what we see happening there for the rest of the First Age, for almost the whole rest of the First Age. In Beleriand. With the men, it's not quite so clear. That is, it's never really explained explicitly that what went on with men back in the days that they no longer remember, was similarly a kind of rebellion. So we'll see. When we come across those references, we can talk about this a little bit more then. But I mean, it certainly might be a factor. Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, I was thinking back to, and I'm not remembering exactly, but it's probably back in the Ainulindale. I believe it was said that the vision of the music was taken away before, the Valar knew about men coming, but it seemed like they didn't really know much about them at all. And that might be one reason that they were kind of standoffish, because they didn't really understand them very well. And that almost maybe implies that perhaps that they had instructions through Manwë or whatever that maybe they ought to go softly where men are concerned. I thought that maybe that might be a factor as well.
Yeah. The passage there, it's in the Ainulindale, says that the vision is taken away prior to the fulfillment of the dominion of men. And I think that the reference to the dominion of men suggests not the coming of men, but basically the point, the arrival of the dominion of men is at the end of the Third Age. Right. That's what, you know, like what Aragorn and Gandalf talk about after the War of the Ring, when they're up on the mountainside looking for the sapling of the tree. Now the time has come of the dominion of men. This is what, you know, Galadriel talks about this, Elrond talks about this. This is the time, you know, the time of the fading of the firstborn is now there. So that seems to be basically like through all of the published Tolkien texts, that's where the vision stopped. And so the stuff that Tolkien didn't write, the Valar don't know about, which is kind of interesting. In other words, modern history, essentially, they don't know about. There is also that passage in the in the Ainulindale, which I can't find, because I can't find and talk about it at the same time. When it's talking about the freedom of men, the free will of men, and how to the elves, like humans kind of remind them of Melkor. So there are ways in which the Valar do seem to be, a little bit uncomfortable with men. And they're certainly, again, you know, like that, the reference I made before to the partnership between elves and Valar, the elves are also like more akin to the Valar. I mean, they're like, you know, they're little cousins, whereas men are strange to them. I mean, if you look at the long list of names, the things that the elves called men, the inscrutable is one of them. And you do get the impression that it's possible that to the Valar, they're a little bit inscrutable too. Dave, go ahead.
What did I want to say about this again? I just want to reiterate, I think it's by design. I think the very fact that men were given the gift of death, that no one, not the elves, not the Valar, not anybody, has any idea what happens to them after they die. I think that the fact that, as you just mentioned, that the Valar's vision of the sort of the story line or the music of the world it extends right up until the real dominion of men begins. I think the fact that they're uninvolved doesn't. I mean, there might be all these other side reasons, but I think it boils down to that's just the way that Iluvatar meant for things to unfold, that there's these two very different kinds of children of Iluvatar, and one of them are sort of inextricably bound to the Earth and inextricably bound to the Valar, who are also inextricably bound to the Earth. And then you have these other children who are sort of just kind of visiting, who are transient, and they're there for a little while, and they interact with the Valar, and while they're on Earth, they kind of have to play by the Valar's, while they're on Arda, they have to play by the Valar's rules, but at the end of the day, they're sort of, you know, very, very, like, they really are their visitors or aliens or something, and the mm-hmm. Valar, you know, they just don't have much to do with them, that they're not directly involved in the kind of the narrative that the men will go through.
Yeah, yeah, and even that sense, you know, one other sort of corollary, Dave, I think, to what you're saying is that there's this sense in which, to some extent, the men are legitimately less subject to the authority of the Valar because they're only briefly living under it. You know, they are destined for somewhere else outside of the direct dominion of the Valar. You know, they're only just temporary residents. The elves, being bound to the world, they are always going to be working with and subject to the Valar. But, you know, no matter what, the Valar only rule over men for a few decades, and then they're done. Now, of course, when it comes to one of the Valar, namely Morgoth, this is a good thing. Here I would give a plug again to my student Alison Fishbach's thesis chapter on Turin Turambar here, where she makes this argument, and we talked about it a bit in the conversation that I recorded with her a couple months ago, that, you know, death ultimately is their escape from the dominion of Morgoth, and there's nothing he can do about it. He wants to think that he has total dominion over them and they can never escape him, but of course not only is it possible for them to escape him, it's impossible for him to prevent them from escaping him, any of them, because they're all going away. And they're going where he's not going to reach them and where they're no longer subject to him or any of the other of the powers. So yeah, I mean, in a real way, their whole relationship to, you know, the structure of authority and rulership in Arda is just different than elves, fundamentally. Joe?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that this relates to what you were saying. And also, like, it's like they belong to Iluvatar. Like, you see this later in the Akalabeth that it's like, you know, that they're meant for him really more than anybody else, which ties into everything you just said. And mm-hmm. also, it seems like, you know, Morgoth mentioned something about the men coming and how the Valar really, like, preferred them, or they were going to let them rule over Middle-earth. And it just seemed like maybe if the Valar would have said, hey, man, you're allowed to come over, but the elves and chief could have, you got to stay over there. I didn't know, I mean, this is slight, but maybe it could have created some spite. Maybe the elves would have became even more angry against the Valar, and who knows what could have happened. Like I said, I don't think it's very possible, but you never know.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's not clear. I mean, another thing, of course, is at least we see later, we know this to be true later on, that is in the Third Age, that when mortals go to Valinor, they burn out. I mean, they die quickly. They can't handle it. They're just, like, constitutionally, they can't handle Valinor. What makes, you know, the sort of the glory and the bliss that made the first generation Eldar into Kalaquendi, you know, even a lesser version of that, even the post-darkening, even the post-trees version of that, just burns. It heals and cleanses, but it burns them out. They can't take it. And so, I mean, would things have been different in the First Age? Had the fathers of men been taken over? You know, would they have been able to survive? Could they have been increased and improved and strengthened and changed? I don't know. Possibly. I mean, we're not given any real data on that, but I do think that we do have some reason to think that not only is it not necessarily desirable, it's not even really practicable. Joe, go ahead.
Now, I was going to say, there is one special case at the end of Calibeth where men do live forever, but they did a bad thing, and that was because Iluvatar decided to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a special case.
right, exactly. Yep. Okay, let's see, some other topics have been sort of piling up here. Joe, actually, let's stick with you here for a second. You were asking about the elves in Beleriand, the Sindar. I think you mean Thingol and Círdan the Shipwright and Company? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I couldn't remember like the classification that they were named in, really, so I kind of wung it. But I was asking, yeah, it mentions, you know, Beleriand finally turning green, and that means that, you know, before there really wasn't much there, but maybe except like rocky stuff and trees, I don't know. I was wondering what they were doing during that. I mean, were they just building? And, you know, obviously it must have all been done by torchlight and like the stars. I just never really imagined them building in the dark until now. It just puts a different perspective on things. Like even the scene where Thingol meets Melian, like, you know, I kind of thought of it as daylight at first, and then reading that just kind of switched everything. Wow, it's more of like a darker scene. It was just different. It just, kind of switched things around. It just made me wonder what exactly they may have been doing.
Yeah. No, it's a really good question. And it is true that, you know, Tolkien's vision of the elves and the origins of the elves and the first, you know, huge portion of elvish existence was to be by starlight only. And, you know, this is the thing, interestingly, you know, when we think back to the sun and moon stuff that we talked about previously, and I was talking then in that episode about the kinds of changes that Tolkien was contemplating later on and how he felt that the astronomical myth, of the sun and moon was kind of absurd, and he wanted to change it. And of course, how he wanted to change it, he wanted to make it more consistent with how the world and the solar system really works and really looks like. So, you know, basically the sun was going to have to be there from the beginning. But that's the thing he hated, that although he felt like that was more consistent and it worked better and it was less silly, but he didn't want to lose the fact that the elves were children of the stars and that they awoke and lived for ages under the stars alone without the sun. And so he was basically trying to find a way around that. Like, how can I have the sun be there, and the solar system be essentially like the way that it is, except still have there be only starlight? He was trying to sort of find a way to do both of those things. So yes, it is true that we have to envision everything that has happened up to this point. Of course, we have the light of the trees in Valinor, but on Middle-earth, everything that has happened up to this point, the Sindar, Thingol, and Melian, and Círdan the Shipwright, and the dwarves, and all of them have been living in Middle-earth with starlight only, unvarying starlight only. So dark, yes, but I think not necessarily dark, not dark thematically or dark symbolically. There's a kind of peacefulness to the way that Tolkien describes the dark and the starlight. It is lit. There is light. It's starlight. Now, starlight is very dim. We don't think about starlight as being very bright light. We, being used to the sunlight primarily and moonlight second best, when there is no moon and the stars are out, on a clear night when there is no moon, we look outside and we're like, it's dark out there. You know, you go outside and your eyes can adjust to it, but it's not very much light. And yet, if that's all you knew, if you didn't have the sun by contrast, you would get used to it. It would be light. Now, there's the practical question, of course, Joe, which is like, what were they eating? I mean, if stuff wasn't growing, like, you know, did they have, like, how could they get food? I don't know the answer to that question. And I'm not sure. It's the kind of thing that Tolkien, I think, would have been unlikely not to think about. I mean, he was very detail-oriented, and I think definitely would have been thinking about that. But I don't know exactly what the answer is. Mushrooms? I don't know. So yeah, I'm not sure I know the answer to that question, that pragmatic question. But definitely, yes, we're supposed to be envisioning starlight. Let's see, Jordan, you think that there were some exclusions from the list at the end of the chapter?
Yeah, because at the end of the chapter it lists off these are the elves that, you know, got to be both men and elves, but for some reason it says Elrond, but it doesn't Arwen, and doesn't list Eldarion, and I'm curious why they would have been left off.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that basically the simplest answer to that is that it's not quite looking in so much detail forward. That is, Elrond is generally the one who is like the link. You know, he is the one who is the primary link back to the Elder Days. Galadriel, of course, was there, but he is the sort of the living representative. It's one of the interesting consequences of having the whole Elrond and Elros twin thing, where Elros, the brother who chooses humanity, becomes the one who is the forefather of Aragorn and of the kings of Numenor and the kings of Gondor. So he's the one from whom this noble strain among the humans which is sort of what he's alluding to here. In the glory and beauty of the elves and in their fate, full share had the offspring of elf and mortal. That share in the glory and beauty of the elves is passed down to this one line of humans, the kings of Numenor and then the kings of Gondor and then ultimately to Aragorn. But then at the same time, in parallel, you have Elrond himself, the twin brother of the dude who is the forefather of this entire line. So he is the living relic of that same thing, like that which the one line is descended from. You know, he still is, and he is still hanging out the living connection back to that older tradition, which is not just an ancestral or ancient tradition and legend, but for him living memory. And that, therefore, is what we see at the end of the Third Age, at the end of the Lord of the Rings, when Elrond and Galadriel set sail and go into the West. Remember that reference at the end of it's in the appendices of the Return of the King, when it talks about Celeborn. Finally, he goes and he lives at Rivendell for a while after Galadriel leaves, and then eventually he takes ship, and with him goes the last living memory of the Elder Days in Middle-earth. The last living memory, that's the key. There are still memories, there are still legends, there are still books, Bilbo's books of lore that are handed down, which eventually become essentially the Silmarillion, but the last living memory is gone. So that's who Elrond is, so his significance in this is definitely he is like the bridge to the Third Age. So I think that's why he gets such a central significance there, such a central emphasis at the end of that chapter. Arendil and Elwing and Elrond, their child. Forget Arwen. I mean, Elros. I mean, they had two children, right? Elrond is only one of their children, so we're really choosing favorites here. But I think it's pretty clear why, because we're not talking about Elros yet, because Elros means Numenor and that whole story, and that's a different story, and we'll get to that. But Elrond is the one who is that living link. Let's see, Brandon had a question. I know that he doesn't have a mic. He had a question about the relationship between men and the West, and the travel of men into the West. Is that right, Brandon? Yeah. So, and I think, you know, in a sense, this is one way of opening up again the men and Valar relationship topic that is looking at that from the other end. The men, they have a different relationship with the Valar. They fear the Valar rather than love them, and yet they're drawn into the West. And I think that's a really crucial thing. Almost everything, that is, almost all good people are westward oriented. And we see this is true even in the Lord of the Rings. Even in the Third Age, you've got the whole Lord of the Rings takes place in the north and the west of Middle-earth, and you've got the whole expanse to the south, Harad, and the lands to the east, where the Lord of the Rings map just stops, but there's all of that land out there to the east, which is unmarked and unlabeled and unmapped, and we just know that it's this it's this large, huge land which is pretty much under Sauron's dominion, and the men are coming and serving in his armies and everything. So there's all of this terrain out there, but the further you go, the more it's just like that's Sauron's dominion out there. The further west you go, the more likely you are to find people who are good and faithful. And you can even see this is used as a kind of shorthand. There is no more hope in the West. Like, we have trusted in the West. The West has failed, says Saruman. That's not only just a simple reference to the Valar or a simple reference to Valinor, but it becomes even kind of, it seems to me, a sort of a broader idea. Joe, go ahead.
I was going to say, maybe men could feel they were connected to something bigger, so they sought whatever was closest to that, and technically that's Iluvatar, but they were taught to fear death thanks to Morgoth, so, I mean, it was hard for them to understand that what they were seeking they would really reach after death, so instead, maybe that's why they were trying to make it to the west of the Valar, because they thought, ooh, this is what we're really seeking, it was hard for them to understand that death was really what they needed to find that. So maybe that's why they were trying to get there, because they could feel they had this connection with something big and good, but they just weren't quite on the mark.
Yeah, that's a great point, Joe. I think that we can see the lives of men are marked from the beginning, we're told, with this desire that they can't satisfy, this desire for they don't really know what and which they never really satisfy. And we'll come back to this again when we actually meet men. That is, when they enter Beleriand and become characters in the story, they'll get to Beleriand and they're like, congratulations, you've reached the West. This is the westernmost part of the continent. Your quest is over. And basically they're like, okay, what we were looking for isn't here, but we don't really know what we're looking for. They seem kind of, in a sense, to be looking for Valinor. But, Joe, I think you're absolutely right. What we know about men is, in the end, where their real home is, where their real destiny is, the thing which really will satisfy them is elsewhere. It's not here at all. It's not even in Valinor. So that is, I think, a very important, a very important aspect of humans that we can see from the beginning. They're seeking for something, and the light in the West is the thing which seems to them closest to that thing that they're looking for. I think that that's definitely something that we need to keep in mind when we are thinking about the relationship between the elves and the Valar. Let's see. John, you wanted to talk about man's relationship with the sun. Let's talk about the sun.
Yes, I wanted to talk about especially the symbolic meaning behind the introduction of the sun as basically the icon of men. How we see for the first time, you know, we have heard of the elves before associated with the twilight, as previously discussed, but with men, we're seeing basically a light whose basically radiance is thought to be so brilliant that even the eyes of the children can't look at it for too long, for an extended period of time. So, for me, this brings into focus a new ideology of sense that mankind is of the world. We see, you know, the moon as being far more dimmer and seeming more distant. The light of the sun is, you know, the light force that gives life in the end. It seems to me almost like an extension earlier of almost like the fire of Iluvatar, in this case the fire of the trees, now brought really home in this new sense of awesome might, which can only truly be felt with the coming of men. It seems like almost as though fate, or perhaps Iluvatar himself, has ordained for basically this moment to take place with the awakening of men. Also, I wanted to bring up, along with this, the relationship with man to water. The idea that, you know, Ulmo still remembers mankind and, you know, the exiled Noldoran elves. And we see this connection with nature still present in mankind, but slightly different. You know, we'll see them later called the unfriends.
Yes.
The elves, which I believe it's such an excellent phrase. It's not grammatically correct, of course, but it brings to mind this relationship with the outside world, which is both similar and dissimilar to the lords of the Eldalie and the Mordekwendi. So I'm sure that's enough to go on for now. But, you know,
yeah.
I always found this chapter quite interesting. It's quite short, you know, but there's so much to it. I remember I was clearing with Laura Burkholz whether this was actually the section. I was kind of unsure at first. And when I was going through it, another, moment in the in a different reading of the text from the Library of Congress, I noticed that the emphasis, especially on the sun and the idea of the water, struck me first. Because before, if we return to the earlier chapters, remember mm-hmm. when we were talking about the hiding of Valinor, I think someone brought up the excellent conception, as mentioned in the text, that the Valar were hoarding the light of the two trees.
Yeah.
Laurelin and Telperion in huge vats along with water. Here we see the light and the water once again, except in a new and interesting form.
Yeah, no, yeah. It's
that's pretty much it.
Yeah, it's true. No, you're right, John. There's a lot there. Let me start by going back to their relationship with the sun, and I'll just sort of throw something else in there too, which is what I think is so fascinating about the way that their names. That is, this is in the list of names that they're called. On page 103, and and they named them the usurpers, the strangers, and the inscrutable, the self-cursed, the heavy-handed, the night-fearers, the children of the sun. I that list always makes me think, like, which of these things is not like the other? You know, wait a second. The usurpers, the strangers, the inscrutable, the self-cursed, the heavy-handed, the night fears, those aren't good things. The children of the sun. So wait, is that a bad thing like the other things? It's a fascinating list. Mike, I think you wanted to talk about the list since I'm on this subject. Why don't I let you talk about it too? Is it time for style time? I feel like it's time for style time.
It's always time for style time.
All right. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I love that sentence. I think it's the coolest sentence in this, in the chapter. I love the fact that the names of the men start spilling out faster and more furiously as that sentence goes along. Like, first they're defined in the two languages, but by the end of the sentence, they're getting more negative as you read them. They're just sort of one after the other coming in more rapid succession. My reading of that sentence was that Tolkien wanted to give you another view of the breakdown of the relationship between men and elves. I think in the final paragraph that begins in After Days, when the two races became estranged, he lays out, you know, the relationship in the After Days, and then he finishes up and talks about the relationships in the Early Days. And I think the sequencing of the names here is just his way of giving you that same information in a more condensed format. The first sets of names seem to be the more polite and respectable
polite,
names
yes.
that the elves had for the men in the early days when they were allies and akin. And then those names at the final part of that sentence that are, you know, sort of come in that final string reflect the estrangement. But I think that sentence is terrific.
Yeah, it's true. Polite is a perfect way to say it. The Atani, they were named by the Eldar. The Second People, well, that's pretty neutral, right? Nobody's going to be offended by the Second People. Certainly they were. They call them the Hildor, the Followers. Well, that's a little bit more slanted. The Afterborn. Yeah, okay, you were born first. We get it. The Sickly, the Mortals, the Usurpers, the Strangers, the Inscrutable. Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just adding more on top. I'm just adding on to the pile. I really love that sentence too. In fact, when I was on a run listening to Martin Shaw's recording of this book, I kind of like rewound and re-listened to that sentence multiple times. And I was really struck too by what you were just pointing out, that they get progressively more negative as they go. Although, you know, I guess maybe Children of the Sun's not, like, in and of itself is bad, but since it follows right after Night Fearers, it certainly sounds somewhat derogatory, like, you know, these guys are kind of, oh, they're scared of the dark.
Now, of course, this seems a little hypocritical, right? I mean, we remember the elves in Cui Vienin were terrified of the shadows and the dark, you know, the one who comes in the dark and takes you away and makes you into orcs. but anyway, now we're all high and mighty about that, I guess.
And I wonder, I mean, some of these, I wonder, like, why do they, I mean, I guess, why do they call them self-cursed and heavy-handed? That would seem to do, maybe those are names that, maybe they didn't make up all these names right away. Maybe these are names that developed in time as they had further experiences with men. And it makes me think of Arwen, her comments to Aragorn when he's on his deathbed. And she sort of says that, like, you know, in her relative youth that she sort of scorned men. But only now, you know, going through the experience of Aragorn dying, does she finally understand, you know, sort of what their experiences are like and maybe why they are the way they are. But anyway, I guess the names, maybe they didn't make up all these names right away. Like some of the Children of the Sun and things like that, maybe they would have come up earlier. But some of these later ones, heavy-handed, self-cursed, I mean, it seems like where would they come up with those except, you know, maybe after Turin and some other people and they have direct experience.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And I'm glad you brought up that quote from Arwen. I think that's really interesting. And actually, I'll even read that. Now, she's referring to the story of the Numenorean, so of course, obviously, this would be better after we talked about Numenor, but still, you know, she says, Not till now have I understood the tale of your people and their fall. As wicked fools, I scorned them, but I pity them at last. I mean, we see, as wicked fools, I scorned them. We do get there, I think, a genuine glimpse of the elvish perspective on the Numenoreans in particular and men in general, right? What's wrong with these people? Why are they the way they are? Now she understands, whereas before she recognizes now that she was just ignorant before. And I think that here too, in this list of names, those two that you point to particularly, that is self-cursed and heavy-handed, are definitely the ones which are kind of, which I think are most conspicuous. The others, you know, like the sickly and the usurpers, the strangers, the inscrutable, all of those names actually say more about the elves than they say about the men, right?
Right. That's sort of describing how the elves perceive the men's being. You know, that's sort of describing the fact that they're mortal, the fact that elves just don't get them. But the self-cursed and heavy-handed, those are ascribing to them, like, you know, bad behavior.
Right. Or at least, with heavy-handed, I would say at least clumsiness. You know, a lack of delicacy. And I don't mean delicacy of sensibility, but rather, like, delicacy of touch. That is, they're in a hurry and they do things quickly and rashly and clumsily. Which of course, obviously, they're going to when they only have a few decades to do it. Don't have centuries in which to gain wisdom to figure out how to do it better, and are gonna be likelier to be blundering around and making mistakes. They're heavy-handed. Self-cursed is interesting, and of course here we get back, Elizabeth, I think, to the point that you were making earlier about the kind of the echoes, the still sort of faint echoes that we get of an original sin concept with men. There is something about them. They do just screw up a lot. You know, I mean, they mess things up for themselves quite a bit. So the elves perceive that they're self-cursed. And two other things that I would say about this list. One is, if ever we needed, you know, evidence or reminder that this book was written by elves and from the elvish perspective, here it is, right? I mean, this list is so plainly, elvish slanted. And I don't just mean like biased towards the elves, but written from within their understanding. or rather, you know, sort of testifying to their lack of understanding. But the second thing that I would say about it is, again, that final contrast between the night fearers and the children of the sun. And that, I think, is a really fascinating thing. I don't think that children of the sun is supposed to be sort of a bad or insulting thing, even though it comes at the end of this long list of questionable descriptors. But it does certainly, when put right next to night fearers, it makes me think of the orcs, except in reverse, right? As we saw, both Morgoth and his creatures, when the sun rises, they're terrified of the sun, and they always have a problem with the sun. Orcs always will have a problem with the sun. Remember, Treebeard explains this in The Two Towers. It is a sign of the things that came in the great darkness that they can't abide the sun, Treebeard explains. They're dark creatures. They are made for the dark, and the sun postdates their programming, right? They were not designed to handle sunlight. The humans are the flip side of that. They're the children of the sun. They woke when the sun woke. They don't remember the darkness. Remembering Tom Bombadil's phrase, I remember the dark under the stars when it was fearless, right? They don't remember fearless darkness. They're children of the sun. They are native to light. And so to them, night, darkness, is an anomaly. That's the thing that they're not programmed for. They're programmed for sunlight. And they don't know how to handle darkness. So they are night fearers even more and in a different way than the elves, were night fearers by the shores of Quivienen.
Brandon, reminds us on the Children of the Sun thing, the scene with, Gandalf and Theoden.
Oh, when he brings him, outside to see the light?
The cure for his ailments and his depression is not an exorcism or hitting him in the head with his magic staff, but
right.
Just basically taking him outside and saying, hey, look, the sun's still up.
Yeah. Yes. It is not so dark here, says Theoden, right? Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly. That's how, I mean, even thinking all of that persistent language, you know, the Sauron language with the shadow and everything, the shadow is passing. That's, you know, light for humans, from a human perspective, light is, you know, light and sunlight in particular, that is the norm. That is goodness. Whereas the darkness, for elves, it's not like elves are pro-darkness. They will speak of the dark and the shadow as being a bad thing. But they too remember the dark under the stars when it was fearless, at least to some extent. And they are not afraid of the night time. They are not afraid of starlight. They don't consider starlight darkness. Whereas humans seem to do so. Mike, you wanted to add something else?
Just finally, I also got stuck with that children of the sun term as the final term. I really wanted that to be a term of sort of final understanding between the elves in relation to men. And it doesn't really add up, I think, in some of the ways that you've mentioned. I think the correct term for men is in that first part of the paragraph where they say that, you know, the first rising of the sun, the younger children of Iluvatar awoke. So it's not the children, men are not the children of the sun. They are properly understood as the younger children of Iluvatar. But in the very end, the elves, in naming the men, in the final analysis, don't name them that. They name them all these other names, and finally the children of the sun, which leaves me with a feeling like there is sort of a unresolved jealousy or misunderstanding at the very end.
Yeah, yeah. No, exactly. I mean, and the jealousy thing, I mean, usurpers, hello, usurpers? Remember, that was the lie of Morgoth to Feanor, that Feanor was like unconsciously spreading, that is, not thinking that he was ventriloquizing Morgoth. When Feanor makes his speech, you know, no other race shall oust us, right? That's wicked thinking, to think of the men as usurpers. That's what Morgoth was trying to deceive them into doing in order to build rivalry.
And then in the next page over, they're accusing men of usurping the sunlight. So it's there.
Yeah, Exactly. So, I mean, that's, I do think that you can see some genuine, not just the Elvish perspective, but like Elvish hang-ups there. Dave, go ahead.
I was going to say, does that, or should we understand that to mean that there are sort of hints in here of some of Morgoth's lies and corruption, that the elves, whoever it is that's writing these stories down, they're still not even free of Morgoth's, of the sort of pollution of Morgoth, as they've assimilated some of the language that he taught them?
I think that's possible, though I don't think we need necessarily see that name in this list, or any even the others in this list, as a kind of unconscious act, you know, that like the person who wrote this was himself sinning, you know, in thinking that way, but rather it is, I think it would be possible to read it as sort of an honest admission on the part of the writer, like, I will confess that this, because remember, this is a list of the things that they were called. And so some of these, presumably, some of the things they're going to be called, are they going to be called some things by bad people, you know, in bad circumstances, right? So some of these things might have been, you know, might have been names given to men by, like, you know, Carinthir, or like, you know, one of the jerks. So it's possible that he's saying, look, I'm going to report the bad with the good. You know, it's true that like among elves, these are the various names, and that, you know, that the author, the teller of the story might not be proud of all of these names, but I'm going to come clean and say these are the things which elves have called humans. I think it's possible to read it that way, rather than the speaker kind of unconsciously falling into this same deception there. But it's possible. Yeah, I mean,
I guess I didn't mean it quite like that. I just sort of more, I wonder if the elves would call them usurpers if Morgoth hadn't first told that to them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, yeah, they're definitely, I think, no. I mean, that, I think, well, I say definitely. I think that's pretty much covering my bases there. I don't think so. At least we're told that he planted that. But I don't think that we're supposed to be thinking that, you know, golly, if it hadn't ever been for Morgoth, all of the elves, like no elf would ever have sinned or done or thought anything wrong.
Anything against them, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, of course, I guess you could say all of, you know, all of this evil stuff comes from the discord of Melkor and the music in the first place, but...
Well, I think that's an oversimplification. I was struck by that. I don't know why I didn't even think of it when I was first reading it, but looking at it now, I sort of thought, I remembered back to that, and I wondered, like, we're sort of supposed to be thinking about the echoes of Morgoth. I mean, this is jumping ahead, but there's a sentence in next chapter where Morgoth's sort of reflecting on the Noldor's arriving in Middle-earth, and, you know, he's gotten his butt kicked a couple times, but at the same time he has this gleeful thought where he realizes that these sort of the seeds of discord and disagreement amongst the different groups of elves and between elves and men is already there. He, like, looks and sees, like, hey, all right, you know, all those lies and things that I told and all those things I set in motion are, you know, I'm getting my payoff from my plant. And I'm just wondering, you know, like if we should see that here as well, that it's not that he's the root of all evil and they wouldn't have done anything bad if it wasn't for him, but nevertheless he had an impact or an influence on them, and that even the most noble elves maybe don't escape that, as good and as noble and as high as they might be in the later ages, even after he's been imprisoned, maybe there's still echoes of his corruption throughout all, you know, all creation, and maybe in each individual.
Yeah, yeah, no, I mean, I definitely think that that's certainly possible. And, you know, I think, you know, there's that wonderful sentence, you know, he who sows lies will not lack of a harvest. I think that was back in Valinor. So yeah, no, we can certainly see the implications of that. Yeah, and I think, oh wait, before we move off from the sun, Brandon, you made a comment about a Hobbit comment, I think, about the Daisy riddle. Yeah, I know you've got no mic. You want to spell that out a little bit more? I mean, I remember the etymology, of course. Daisy comes from the Anglo-Saxon phrase, the day's eye, and so the sun being the eye of the day. And you know, if you think about how that riddle goes, and the eye in the blue face, and the eye in the green face, and the one eye in low place, and the other in high place. So that the concept of the sun as the eye, which is really fascinating, because this is in the Riddles in the Dark chapter in The Hobbit. Interestingly, this is the riddle that Bilbo makes up completely on the spot. And it's, you know, sort of, I think the most Tolkienian of all of these riddles. He made up or at least made up the wording of all of them. But this is a philologist's riddle. So I mean, it's hard not to see this as being sort of specially Tolkienian in some sense. But yeah. So no, that idea of the sun as the eye of the world, and yeah, you know, it is interesting to think about that in connection with the men being children of the sun. Actually, kind of bringing the discussion back full circle, or circling back a while. To the apparent neglect of the Valar, and them sort of are they not paying attention? Well, if they're children of the sun, and the sun is the eye of the world, then the eye of day. No, they're being watched over. By definition, they've been watched over since day one. They're being watched over by the sun, and this sort of the sun as emblem of this, especially thinking again of the way that the sun comes off in the Sun and Moon chapter, this is the strategy. This is a strategic move by the Valar to counter Morgoth. You know, the sun is set in a sense like to guard Middle Earth, and help to protect them. So yeah, they're the children of the sun. They're not totally neglected. Yeah. Thanks, Brandon, for pointing that out. I wasn't at all thinking of that riddle, but I think it's a really neat connection. Let's see, just a couple more, I think. Joe, you had a question about Elrond and Elros, but I think we're going to have to wait on that one. We're not going to have enough data yet to answer the question about the choice given to Elrond and Elros. We should wait until the choice is given. And as we'll see, not just to them, the choice is going to be given to Arendil and Elwing as well. But yeah, we'll have to wait till we get to the Arendil chapter for that, I think. Jordan, you wanted a question about the Halls of Mandos?
Well, sort of. We kind of covered it in the text. The idea that the Halls of Mandos, I guess, are so large, and there are people that are leaving, like Glorfindel, and yet they don't know if men are there or not, seems bizarre, but sort of in our little text conversation, we discussed that either there's a separate chamber with men, and anytime anyone asks about it, Mandos has some pithy response, and they can't get a straight answer out of him, or that the entire thing is like a hall of mirrors where no one can see anyone else. You have no idea what's happening there because it's just basically Mandos's personality in hall form.
Yeah, I mean, they're called the Halls of Awaiting, you know, and there is a sense in which I think that some of the times that the Halls of Mandos are describing, it does sound a bit solitary. That is, you know, this is a time where you go, this is quiet time, this is alone time. You know, this is reflection time. And but yeah, the halls of waiting for men, which are plainly purgatorial, ultimately, that this seems to be the waiting place on the road to wherever they're going after. But yeah, this is and I think thinking about Mandos in geographical terms, that is sort of imagining a floor plan for Mandos and trying to guess, the square footage of the Halls of Mandos is, I think, ultimately not going to be very profitable. That is, sure, they must be very big, but then on the other hand, we're not talking about bodies here anyway. Nobody in Mandos has a body Do they? No, I don't think so. No, nobody in Mandos has a body. That's where spirits go. And so, like, we're not really talking about the same kind of geospatial relations as we're talking about, you know, in, like, a boarding house. So so I do think that, you know, the halls of Mandos could be quite small, theoretically. I don't think they take up a lot of room. But certainly, we're told... You know, we're told that there's a firewall there between where the humans go and where the elves are, which of course is one of the things which kind of adds to the mystery for elves of humans and human destiny, because of course there are those among the Eldar and Valinor who've been to Mandos. I mean, they can report back on Mandos, but they still don't know because they haven't gotten a glimpse over even into what's going on with the humans over there in Mandos, not to mention the fact that, of course, they needless to say, don't know where they go afterwards. Let's see, Dave, you had a dwarf-related question, though I'm suspecting you might be thinking of a different chapter, because I don't think the dwarves were mentioned in this chapter, but we can check. What were you thinking about dwarves? You said something about dwarves. I know you did. Something about dwarf stealing treasure or something like that?
Oh, we've long since moved beyond, way past that point.
Okay.
Mostly okay. I was just, when we were talking about the early drafts of The Hobbit and the fact that the Elven King might indeed be Thingol, I was just pointing out that there's that line where they say that the dwarves and the wood elves never got along, and, you know, they each had their different stories about why, and it had something to do with, you know, the elves said it was because they stole the Elven King's treasure, and the dwarves said it's because the Elven King didn't pay them. I think that's right. And I was just thinking, like, well, that is exactly Thingol's story. So I'm wondering if that was a vestigial sentence that's left over from the early drafts where the Elven King is indeed Thingol.
Yeah, or at least you can see the close connection there. Because even in the later versions, Thranduil is a Sindar. I mean, you know, he's related back to the people of Doriath. So yeah, even when he becomes not Thingol, they still remember it perfectly well, and that is the place where the grudge between dwarves and elves comes from. So yeah, we'll see that a little bit later on. Okay, good. I think Mike, go ahead.
I was going to ask you this at the beginning in terms of defining terms. This isn't defining a term, but the question, who knows where men go after the time of waiting? And Tolkien says, only Mandos under Iluvatar save Manwë knows. Wait, I read that wrong. Mandos under Iluvatar alone save Manwë knows. So yeah. What does that mean?
Okay, that Mandos is the only one who knows where humans go, except Manwë. He knows too. But Mandos, other than Manwë, Mandos is the only one who knows. That's the way I understand that sentence. But even there, it's not obvious that Mandos or Manwë, either one of them, has any kind of sort of direct access to humans and where humans are, because humans leave the circles of the world and the Valar are bound to the circles of the world as long as the world lasts. So in this way, I think that, you know, the humans do move outside of the reach and outside of the knowledge even of Mandos. But Mandos is there to see them off wherever it is that they do go. So he knows about it. Even if he doesn't access it, or even if it's not under, you know, it's sort of, you know, they pass out of his jurisdiction. But he escorts them to the border, so he knows. And Manwë knows too. So that's how I understand that sentence. Well, good. I think we've had a good discussion of our 2.5 pages of text here this evening. Any final questions that anybody has before we go?
No, I just had a question. Is the Avari that are the elves that never left Quivienen?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, I always get the names mixed up. Do we hear about them anymore, or is this the final reference to them?
This is going to be one of the final references to them. Um, I I'm sort of thinking forward. There might be one or two stray references, but this is, I think, the closest we're going to get to meeting them as characters. They're not gonna come up a whole lot more, because again, everybody's moving west. When humans awake, way out in the east, you know, we briefly pan over to the east to Hildorian, but then the men are gonna come west, and then we're only gonna be concerned in this story with the men that are in the far west, you know, where there aren't any Avari. So the Avari aren't gonna really come into it again much more. This is gonna be, I do believe this is the most we'll see of the Avari, for the rest of the time.
Yeah, I just have always wondered what happened to the Avari, and I wonder if the blue wizards are out hanging with the Avari somewhere.
Maybe. We don't know. I mean, when we say that it's out in the east, you know, that they're out in the east, is that still the east of Middle Earth, you know, of Third Age Middle Earth, which is where the blue wizards went? Possibly. You know, one can certainly imagine the blue wizards trying to recruit, you know, assistance with the Avari out there. That would be, you know, if I were writing that story, I would certainly be tempted to go there. But yeah, we don't know. Dave, go ahead.
I just wanted to comment on the positive, optimistic upswing to the end. I really like the last paragraph where it talks about, you know, even though after the triumph of Morgoth, which actually that's very interesting, what exactly is the triumph of Morgoth? But I like the fact that it finishes by saying sort of, in the dawn of years, elves and men were allies and held themselves akin. And there were some among men that learned the wisdom, yada, yada, yada. I like the idea that they sort of pay lip service to the fact that even though they become estranged in later days, at the beginning of things were pretty good. These guys, they thought of themselves as akin, they thought of themselves as brothers, they were allies in the war against Morgoth, and it's sort of a nice sort of, you know, hopeful note at least, because of course the reader knows that we're still in the midst of those early days. In fact, we're sort of earlier than them, so we get to, you know, we know that we're about to launch into sort of the heyday of elves and men working together.
Yeah, exactly. And that, therefore, one thing, of course, that this certainly helps with is to put into its appropriate context the last alliance between elves and men, at the end of the Second Age, you know, with Elendil and Gil-galad. Of course, in the context of the Lord of the Rings, the Battle of the Last Alliance, as of course, is done in the film. It's the beginning, right? I mean, it's like that's the origin. That's where everything starts in a sense. And so it's tempted to see that as like, well, it's like the first and last alliance, right? I mean, we don't see anything else other than that. But the fact that it's called the Last Alliance points to this ancient tradition, and the Last Alliance between Gondor, you know, or basically between the Numenoreans and the elves, you know, it's last, of course, not only because it's the last time they're really going to team up like this, but of course it's the last time they can team up like this, because it's the last time they're going to be around as equals. It's the last alliance between the Numenoreans and the Noldor, because there aren't going to be many more Noldor after this, and there aren't going to be any Numenoreans after this pretty soon. So anyway, but I do think that it's important to see it in this context, that when Elendil and Gil-galad get together and say, hey, we're allies, we're akin, let's join together and fight against Sauron, that this is a return to this ancient and far better system, that, you know, this is stepping backwards across time, across all of those lies and deceptions which have divided men and elves, and back to what were really the good old days. And I think it's important to sort of see that here and see that pattern being established. And this is why, that's why the Last Alliance was such a big deal. Because they were doing it right again in ways that it hadn't been done right for thousands of years. Even when we see in other times in the Second Age, the Numenoreans working alongside, the elves, it still doesn't really happen like that. The Numenoreans, it's just, their partnership is not really the same. But there we can see it. So I do agree. You know, this is what we're, that last paragraph is really neat. And that's why I think it's also really cool that we end with Arendil and Elwing and Elrond. That is the actual joining of those two. Elrond in his person represents the, you know, he didn't just take part in the Last Alliance. He is the Last Alliance, you know, by his nature, by his, you know, in his genes, he is the Alliance of Elves and Men. And you know, so I think that that's a really, again, another way in which Elrond serves as a kind of focal point, as a kind of bridge. And I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
but
that's true. The early men are so cool because they don't have all this baggage that they inherit from the downfall of Numenor. It seems like there's so much baggage weighing down the later men, even the high men of like Gondor and even Aragorn. And these early men, they don't have all that, and it seems like the interplay between the two races is not weighed down by the long history. So
yeah.
I love when we get into these early stories of the men and elves interact. It's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, and the whole self-cursed thing isn't quite so obvious all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, at least it won't be for a while. There are some, of course, some are more self-cursed than others, Turin, but yeah, in general, we don't always see that. And yeah, no, I agree. These early stories are really cool. Now, having gone here, that is, having talked about men, because this is the time of the rising of the sun, and so men have woken up, they're not, of course, going to enter the story still for several chapters. So we're now going to go back for several weeks before we get men again. So the chapter, The Coming of the Men to the West, is when they will finally become actual characters in these stories. And all of the, you know, discussions of this chapter are still sort of largely theoretical. But anyway, good. Well, thanks everybody.
That's the end of tonight's session. Join us next time for the chapter entitled Of the Return of the Noldor. Thanks for listening, and farewell wherever you fare.
Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.